So, good evening, everyone. I will not take speaker time away, and we are starting on time. I would like to introduce you to our next speaker, Marc Jan Bastian. He is an experienced software engineer working in embedded systems, and he will tell us about concepts of hardware development and control in his talk, Radio Chips and Failure Modes, World Radio Spectrum Domination Through Silicon Control. Give a big applause to our next speaker, Marc Jan Bastian.
Hello, welcome everybody. We will give a quick outline about several things which I've experienced last decade on embedded software development. I will give a very quick overview about SPI signals. Many people are known with those interfaces. It's been used a lot on the board itself. Talk a little bit about the role of patents in semiconductor and IP licensing. Actually, my name appears on a few patents, not related to radio, by the way. There are a few concepts there that you have to understand while debugging hardware. I will give one example, because it's very simple and analog, about the proprietary extension of the USB protocol. It's already very old. And after that, I will move into radio-based real radio chips, RF protocols, and specifically direct sequence spread spectrum, one of the modulation forms which is used both in GPS and a variant of it as well in Wi-Fi. And after that, I will give a few remarks about things which you can do as an embedded developer to ensure success of your product. This is maybe people have seen this. This is a screenshot from SLI's logic analyzer. You see here a very simple system with a rising clock edge. And on the bottom, you will see the digital signal, and that's encoded to C7 hexadecimal. It's very simple. This is on one platform, and then on another hardware platform, if you try to output the same signal with a specific mode of that chip, then all of a sudden you see this. And this is very interesting. Here we see five clock cycles with the same result, there's still C7. There's see a lot of time without any clock cycles, and then all of a sudden you see 3 bits. This is very curious. How could that happen? I was looking into this, and how can you develop silicon which outputs these patterns in a simple way? And what I found is this, transaction level modeling. You can make a model of all the transactions that are being passed over SPI bus. For example, on the SPI flash chip, read, write, and erase, those are separate commands. After that, there comes an address and a few other parameters. You can determine which patterns and sequence are normal, and you can see which patterns might need to be transformed. Then you can modify the content of the transaction that happens actually inside this silent period. And then you can, during that time, you have to hold back the clock that outputs this SPI transactions. You have to also optimize that logic, so you need a hardware proxy. You have to make specific RTL to actually reduce the number of gates that you that are being used. You having a successful hardware proxy. Well, what you can do with that, you can, for example, enforce a protocol license or a proprietary extension that needs to be part of a software that runs on this chip in order to make it all work. Why would you do that? Indeed, implement an extension or a variant of an existing protocol, enforcing licensing terms or revenue of a specific software that you need to put on that SOC to actually make it work properly. And also to maintain vendor control, so that's the chip vendor, of a software updatable hardware platform. Well, software updatable hardware platforms are everywhere. I mean, everybody here on the camp got their own one. It's a very nice one. It has both a USB interface and a Wi-Fi interface. And it would be nice if you can update your software, which you built completely yourself, both via USB and via Wi-Fi. For patents, I will give you a small example. Well, USB serial bus is very well known, billions of connectors. It's the best computer standard, I think, of the whole computer industry, thanks to Apple and Microsoft pushing that thing in the late 90s. The tests of the USB protocol are very well specified. USB IF, Back in the days, early USB days, I think it was Brad Hosler who actually specified that. So electrical specification, the rise times of cables, controlled impedance traces, all that part was so very well specified, and there were many tests available to really make sure the USB became the most interoperable standard. Protocol test software is also freely available. There are many virtual machines and other ways to actually monitor on the host controller level or actually operating system level. But there's also a lot of hardware analyzers. For example, there's Elisys in Switzerland, who's making lots of USB analyzers, which can decode almost all aspects of all the traffic over USB bus without actually interfering with the timing of the USB itself. So that's very important, because if you're debugging two pieces of hardware talking together, well, you also want to make sure there's no nothing interfering with the timing to make sure you're not interfering with the process. But nevertheless, there are proprietary extensions also to USB. This is a proprietary extension that I found back in, around 2009. The patent itself came from was filed, I think, in 2005. There are several versions of the patent, but you can look it up. It will be in the next sheet. USB consists of two lines, basically, or four lines. One pair is power, 5 volt and ground, and the other one is differential, D plus and D minus. This is the other. That's a nice 19 ohm differential pair. There are a few points in the protocol where the signal is not differential, but it becomes single-ended. And that's during the end of packet symbol and during a bus reset. And the bus reset is used for speed negotiation. So if you want to go for USB 1, then it's 12 megabits or sometimes 4 megabits, if you depending on which line you pull up as a device. And on the for higher speed, you need different line drivers which drive more current through the bus. And there's a special protocol that's being played during that reset. The threshold voltages for those things are also very well specified, but you can create additional threshold voltages, and that was made into a patent. This is a patent. I will not mention too many names in here, but there is a patent number here on the side, which you can look up, and then you can find all the names. This is on the left, you see the scale. There's 3.3 volts, 1 volt. And then it's not completely linear in the bottom, so there's 130 millivolts and 100 millivolts. And the difference of that is actually being used to signal or do a secret handshake between host controller and the device, which is quite curious. But it also means that if you have, for example, different length of cable or different thickness, then you might have an influence on the result of that speed negotiation or the reliability of your device. So that's a very interesting patent. If you see intermittent issues with USB, well, you might actually think, well, maybe I should use a shorter USB cable just to get things working. And the host controller itself was also mentioned. This is a later version of the patent, and here you see, the host controller itself says here, let's select a lower zero voltage threshold, so the op-amp, which actually has to compare the voltages, is actually being influenced here. Well, now let's go to radio chips, because, there's nothing more analog than a radio signal. What is all in a radio chip that might not be completely known to everybody? There are many things there. There's low noise amplifiers, SAW filter. There's a surface acoustic wave. That's a very narrow band filter, which is mainly, for example, used in GPS receivers. There are modulators, voltage controlled oscillators, phase lock loops, and phase detectors. That's all through creating a beautiful, clean carrier wave or local oscillator. There's analog device analog to digital and DA converters, of course, which you'll also find in sound cards, except in radios. Usually they have much more bandwidth. I mean, audio card stops at 192 kilohertz. And AD converters and DA converters, which you can find in wideband Wi-Fi transceivers, then can go up to 200 megasamples per second today. So those are significant bandwidths, which produce also a lot of data. I mean, if you get 14-bit AD or a DA converter, those things can generate 800 megabytes per second, which is a bit difficult to process in software. But you can do it in hardware much better, because you have all the multipliers close by. The console. There's also other analog things. Very old ones is the bandgap reference. That's something to get a stable voltage for all the other analog parts. Crystal drivers. That's something which is used in some power control, because crystals cost time, takes power. Good clocks also take quite a bit of power, and you want to have some choice in that. So there's also that's also the reason the power consumption to having a 32 kilohertz. And a tens of megahertz clock in your chip, and those crystals are being turned on and off all the time just to conserve power. There's automatic gain control. That's basically analog amplifier or voltage gain amplifier. There are power amp control. That's for all if you want to transmit also with it. There are specific drivers which actually push in enough current in it, and there's lots of interfacing circuitry for your analog sections. So while these are all things which are usually abstracted by many people that develop device drivers, but it's all part of a chip, and there's a lot of IP in this area. Then we have the digital section. Typically it's all done in a CMOS process. There's preamble detection, the clock recovery, demodulation and modulation. Those things for data signaling can usually be done all in digital hardware. Preamble detection is usually kind of a correlator-like approach. So if you use a correlation process, that way you can easily track what is the is this packet for me, or is it just noise which is found on the radio? The clock generation and modulation. Sometimes you need to have a calculated clock offset. For that you also have to do some calculations. The modulator and power amp control. Power amp control, digital predistortion, envelope tracking. Those are things very specific for transmission. These are also made to actually make the hardware as cheap as possible. Because a power amp in a mobile phone, you only have 4.2 voltage of the. Of the lithium-ion battery, and you want to put as much power of that into your antenna, and for that you need having some local optimizations to actually push this amplifier into distortion. It's a bit like a guitar amplifier. If you push it into distortion, it sounds much nicer. But for digital communications, that's not good, because if you get distortions, you get more harmonics, and your signal is not your system is not linear anymore. So you have to pre-distort it, and then you get a more linear output. And that way you get a better output. There's a few some audio codecs and encryption acceleration as well. A few things that you also find in radio chips. I will skip a bit through this because this is all about removing DC components, analog transceivers. You cannot send a very long one string into them. They will need some 1-to-0 transitions to recover the clock and keep synchronized have the receiver synchronized with the transmitter. Same, you also find the PCI Express, which is also a serial signal, which has similar properties. And you also get a few K symbols. So if you program FPGAs, you also have SerDes interfaces, and there you have actually access to all the K symbols which are inside those things. So that's always very nice to actually look into both the specification of the protocol and the specification of the FPGAs if you can actually accommodate all those protocols. Then there's a lot of software in the radio baseband. Power management. So we want to spend as much time in low power modes, just turn off clocks, turning off low noise amplifiers. Those things are all quite power hungry. And you also want to reduce leakage current, because modern chips, you're having so much logic that the total amount of leakage current of this big plane of CMOS logic is getting significant. So in that case, you also sometimes want to power off parts of that as well. The radio IP. well, just like you saw on USB, in Radio RP there will also be proprietary extensions. Sometimes those extensions do not provide a clear benefit, but sometimes you just must license additional things just to get that part of the radio working. Plant obsolescence is also an issue, of course, for many consumer electronics, while having those kind of things in there. Just having a little bit slower of older protocols, so it breaks a bit of compatibility. Then you have new licensing terms and software. Then I'll provide a quick, simple example for radios. GPS is, I think, the most compatible radio system ever invented, I think. It was designed by the US Air Force. It was a very nice system. It's an open specification, thanks to Ronald Reagan's response to a Cold War incident. I think that's very, very beneficial for everyone, and it became also open to a big market for consumer applications. Everyone with GPS can determine their own location. You don't have to reveal it to others. You just have to measure all the clocks of all the ones. And it's also very power efficient. I mean, every power, if you look at only at the L1 band, there's around 27 watts per satellite beaming to Earth. So in total for 24 satellites, there's around 400 watts of power being beamed up to Earth. And with that amount of power, everybody on Earth can determine their own location. It's a very great, cool feature. The receive level on Earth is then very low. I mean, most Wi-Fi receivers are having a level of minus 100 dBm, which is basically the noise floor. On GPS, it's minus 128 dBm. And the only way you can receive that signal is by just generating the same signal and then correlating it with the noise you receive. And then you get a correlation peak, and that correlation peak you can track. That system is called CDMA or DSSS. The term CDMA is a bit confusing in the US because CDMA is also a mobile phone standard there. But direct sequence spread spectrum is, I think, the best specification for such kind of modulation. GLONASS is a Russian system. They have your own frequency, so that's completely independent. And you see now also other nations making their own navigation system. For example, EU has a Galileo, which is using exactly the same frequency. And that's also a nice property of DSSS. You can put multiple signals in the same frequency and then still receive them all at the same time, just by the power of correlation. You should not put too many in there, but if you have good negotiations, then that should all work. The most common GPS band is the L1, that's 1575.42 megahertz. It's around 5 megahertz wide. It must be very quiet. You don't want to have too many mobile phones transmitting in a frequency in a few megahertz within that frequency. There are satellite phones which are a little bit below it, but that's about it. And almost everybody will use only the L1 band. The other nice thing about CDMA and DSS systems, they are relatively resistant to CW interference. CW stands here for carry wave, so it's a strong sinusoidal signal, for example, a sideband of a transmitter on a lower band, which can interfere with a GPS signal. To make the correlation work better, there's also CW filters in most digital hardware. That uses DSSS, but its output is usually not output to the end user. So there are some tracking and filtering for it, but usually it's not output to the user. You can use open source hardware, and there's a receiver from SwiftNav would actually use the FPGA for the correlation, and a Maximara front end for digitization, and then you can actually program that stuff yourself. You also need a specific ADC. It needs to be having one or two bit resolution with well-defined levels. The decision between what is a one and a zero, it's much more well-defined on those low resolution ADCs than on the higher precision ones. And you also need a very stable clock because, you have to generate exactly the same clock as used at the GPS receiver satellite. To actually generate the signal and do the correlation, and you have quite a long integration time. So during the correlation time, you have to make sure this clock stays aligned with the other clocks. The way to actually make a GNSS or a global navigation satellite systems like GPS, Galileo, Baidu, GLONASS, you can track and lock CW interference yourself. You can implement your own correlators and trackers. You can, for example, also track direct and reflected signals from because modern receivers, they can trace the GPS signals down to 160 dBm, minus 161 dBm. So there is quite a lot of range also getting, well, track a reflected signal. That's possible these days. You can also use SDRs with more precise clocks. There's lots of open source software available. And nice thing is also you can calculate your own clock offset. And with that, you can make your own time receiver. For example, there are special OCXOs, which you can then control by a GPS signal. And that way, you're having a globally synchronized clock that's used a lot with radio astronomy applications, where you have two stations on the Earth, one on one side, on the other side, looking at the same stars. And then they want to sometimes look for weeks at the same part of the sky, and then do reception for that. For that, they also use GPS to synchronize their clocks. And there's also the signals that I just mentioned, CW interference. They can come from a lower frequency, and which is it has some sidebands in a higher frequency. But what is also possible is that there's military applications that are actually jammers and spoofers or those kind of things. You can also try to pinpoint those using an antenna array. That's another nice application. I don't see, haven't seen a complete application for that yet, but that's definitely something to interesting to research. Then on the IP side, that's a few concluding remarks. Always ask your supplier or supply chain to get full control of the RTL, so the register transfer level logic that goes into their chip, so that you know how to test whether you have a real chip or a clone chip. Ask which patents, revisions, and claims are applicable, so then you can actually verify if there is something going on there, or whether there's something that you might have forgotten. You can also, of course, check your serial SPI and digital interface time. It's very easy. I mean, Celaya Logic Analyzer costs only a few hundred euros, and then you're having a very good timing lock. What you can also do is ask a Verilocker VHDL model. Some vendors already are doing this, and with that you can you can actually verify whether your chip meets the specification. And so now I'm open for questions.
A big applause for Mark John, please.
Oh, thank you.
So, are there any questions for him?
Okay.
No questions. Do you want to tell us something else? You can still use 8 minutes of your time.
8 minutes. Oh, well, there's plenty of time, yeah. This is a small radio tube, which I found at the ham radio show in Friedrichshafen. I thought it was very nice because, it's a very old radio tube, and it actually advertised for better reception, so I think it's applicable for this talk. So I'm not sure how many people using a tube-based radio here, but I wish everybody has the best reception for their radio signals as possible. So.
All right. This hasn't inspired any questions from the audience.
All right.
No one wants to have a world control domination of radio-enabled systems. Well, okay. That's your problem. Well, so thank you very much, Mark John.
Yep.
And again, a big applause for him.